You're listening to Radio Berkman, and we want to know, what good is a record label, anyway? Fortunately for us, as part of our ongoing Rethinking Music series, we sat in on a conversation between friend of the show Chris Bavitz and Dave Herlihy. Chris is the assistant director of Harvard Law's Cyber Law Clinic. He also lectures at Harvard Law. Dave currently teaches at Northeastern, where he supervises the student-run record label and operates his own practice specializing in media law. But 25 years ago, he was the frontman of O Positive, a Boston-area band poised on the brink of every musician's dream, a major label record deal. Dave tells us about his band's trajectory from being the best band in the basement to appearing on the Billboard charts, and what came after. And, with his years of experience both in the studio and behind the contracts, Dave offers his insight into the role of the record label in the 21st century, and the simplest solution to the seemingly intractable problem of media piracy and proper licensing. But first, here's a song by O Positive.
Title at Northeastern these days?
I am an associate academic specialist. Yes. But people just call me Dave.
Is that at the law school or at the university?
I do from time to time speak in the law school, but it's at Northeastern there's a music department, and within the department there are concentrations, and one of them is a music industry concentration that has a very robust student body. And so I teach courses on copyright law, artist management, record industry. I'm also the responsible faculty for Green Line Records, which is the slowly sort of resuscitated student-run record label, whatever that means, really. A record label is just the idea of that is so, 20th century.
Right.
You know, I mean, we joke, but, you know, the idea of a label came from the bit of paper that used to stick to spinning black plastic, you know, and all of those things are just no longer part of the equation.
When O Positive first started, did you want to put out little 12-inch black discs or 5-inch shiny discs or whatever they were?
I think what I really wanted to do was just be a part of the sort of the cultural conversation. I wanted to affect the marketplace of ideas the way that I sort of saw it happening. I grew up as a young kid in the 60s, and my brother had a record collection, and I would hear like Neil Young doing Ohio, or I would hear the White Album, or I would hear Jimi Hendrix, or I would hear Buffalo Springfield, and I'd say, wow, you know, that, you know, to be, you know, sort of, you know, cliched about it, there's something happening here.
Right.
And I really wanted to be a part of that dialogue. Plus, it looked cool to be on stage and, you know, the cliche, you know, meet girls. But I wanted to just be great. And I wanted to be, and I thought music had this just incredible sort of centrality to that cultural dialogue. And at the 60s, the role of music was so powerful against the sort of the fakeness of the 50s. And I thought, wow, this thing that I love actually has a capacity, this sort of indefinable capacity. And so I wanted to be in that game.
And did you have aspirations to do this professionally, or were you doing this because, again, it was a passion and you wanted to be part of the conversation?
Well, in the beginning, I just loved music. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, I didn't understand the social context or anything. I just loved it as it was for the vibration of it. And I had a very musical family, none of whom were sort of insane enough to think that they should try to make a living with their guitar. But as I got older and was in high school and was learning to play, you know, Led Zeppelin songs, and I loved it a lot, but I never really thought about it as a career. I went to college and was a DJ at the radio station and was a political science major and just met a lot of interesting, funny, cool, creative people. And I said, wow, I like this space, But then I graduated, and I went to law school. And then I started actually working for a white-collar crime firm in Boston, and I had this really horrible midlife premonition of myself throwing my life away, defending people who were not that nice. And I just, my stomach got really upset with it, and I had this sort of almost like a nervous breakdown. What am I doing? And so I said, okay, I really must play the guitar. I was always sort of cavalier. You know, I was sort of dismissive of pop music. That sucks. And I finally said, you know, put your money where your mouth is. You know, put your body into it. If you really think that that's bad, put up or shut up. And so then I really tried to be in a band. But my motivation was still to be what I would call like in the Shakespeare Club. Like I wanted to be great.
Right.
And I had the naive belief that if you were great, that everything else would fall into place. If you follow your heart, your wallet will follow, you know, which is not necessarily true. But I just wanted to be great, and I had this overarching just ambition to pull great things out of wherever the hell great things come from.
I know that you had a couple of EPs that came out on sort of smaller independent labels, and this is, I guess, late 1980s?
Right, mid-80s, 85, 87, yeah, 80, 88.
So was this sense of being great tied to getting music released on a label?
Well, that was the way it had to happen, right? In those days, there was that map. Right. You know, and everybody that had, you know, that I had ever heard of followed the map. You know, you needed a record label. Otherwise, you're sort of prenatal. You know, without a record label, you're not in the world. You needed those intermediaries. You know, you needed a label. You needed radio play. You had to appeal at the gates of the gatekeepers and try to get them to lower the drawbridge so you can kind of get in. You needed that. Otherwise, you were just the best band in your basement. I had to follow the footsteps of all of the artists that had come to me because that's how they came to me. Being in Boston with a bunch of sort of rock and roll clubs, I wrote music that would work for the venues that were available to me. You know, had I been living in a place that was all folk music, and the places around me where I could get to required that, then I would have channeled my aspirations down that path. You create, you know, works that can be consumed in the ways around you that will allow their consumption to occur. So that's what I did. And so I realized early on that I was, you know, to borrow a phrase, I was a musician in the alcohol business. They like to hear big driving beats, and I like melodies, so I wanted to have a good melody in there. I like words, even though you can't hear the words in the club. So I wanted to put all those things into the songs. And people came, people danced, people drank. Hey, I like your band. Come back. I was very conscious of the ways that inspiration flowed through for bad phrase, consumers.
So how did you start? You obviously started playing live music in the Boston area, and at some point you were presumably getting out of Boston and doing shows in other places. How did that happen, and was that tied to having had a couple of releases out and some radio airplay for the
directly related
releases?
Yeah, yep. It was the intermediaries were the bridge from my basement to the rest of the world. We were on a record label initially called Throbbing Lobster, and they had some pretty good regional hits, but they had nationwide distribution, and they had connections with radio stations, and they knew the stations that would play bands that sounded unlike us. Having to reinvent the wheel from scratch is just hopeless. You know, there's too much to do, and so you needed someone else. Throbbing Lobster was huge, and local radio, that was how people heard what you did. You had to get on the radio. And then once you're on the radio, then you can get gigs. You know, it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg thing. You know, how do you get the gigs if you're not on the radio? Once you get one domino to fall, then other things can fall and you begin getting better shows. And you work like mad to get your word out. And you harness the power of your fans. We actually had friends of ours who would have O-positive meetings. They'd get together with the band and they would apply, like, people power and organizational principles to my group. I mean, I would say they cut years off our development time because they would have written agendas and they'd go away and come back next week. And, you know, did you get the photograph? Have you done the recordings? Have you done the bio? It's right. And so they really helped us do that. And they also would come to the shows and they'd tell their friends about the shows and their friends would tell friends about the shows and they'd be crowded. And so the whole thing kind of had this real synergy that was, you know, helped by the intermediaries, but also helped by the fans. And so you needed that combination. You needed the conduit, and then you needed the sort of the recipient enthusiasm.
Right. So you talk about this sort of classic map or template that the band sort of followed at the time. you've got independent releases, you've got a great hometown audience, you start to branch out and play out of town, obvious logical next step, you sign to a major label.
Right, and we had a major label deal on Epic Records, and we had, you know, we had a top 10 song in the Rolling Stone charts, and we were, you know, on Billboard and Gabin charts, and there was a definite climb to that process. But, you know, the major label is so complex because there are many departments, each of which has their own agenda. And when you have a complexity of different departments, different budgets, people getting fired, new people coming in, there's a lot of, like, organizational turbulence or inefficiency that comes back on a really good band. Even if all that is sort of miraculously lined up, then you have the marketplace and the radio station's inefficiencies. Or is this what radio is playing nowadays? It's like when our album came out, it was like, you know, hair bands like Warrant and Winger, Eye of the Tiger, these big sort of very different sounding music. We were pre-Nirvana. Not that we were like Nirvana, but if you recall radio pre-Nirvana, it was almost like Mars for a band like us.
How did you get on the radar of Epic Records? Obviously, we're talking a pre-internet era. They were not following music blogs or anything like that. Was it merely a function of these independent releases showing up on airplay on in different cities, on radio stations, and you guys being out on the road and playing shows?
Or? I think it was a lot of that. I mean, I think it's a lot of triangulation. You know, you begin hearing it from a lot of different places. I mean, we were a really good band, and I think that's sort of the starting point for anybody, no matter what. You've got to be really great. I think we're a really great band. And we were selling tickets, and we were selling albums. Our EP in 1987 was the top-selling record at Newbury Comics in the Christmas season. So ahead of REM, ahead of U2. It's a local band, right, but holy cow. Mm-hmm. And so anybody who's in the business of selling those shiny bits of plastic would notice a market like Boston where this, who are these guys? You know, I know these other eight bands, and who's this? There was that. There was also this local video channel, V66, which was a locally owned 24/7 music TV channel before cable had made its penetration. You'd go to Bunratty's or these clubs that didn't have cable, and they'd all have V66 on there. And so, again, when I saw we had a video channel, okay, we're in the video business, boys. Let's make a video. So, again, sort of creating or identifying what sort of template you want to work with or palette you want to work with, depending upon what art galleries are available. So now we have a music TV station. Let's create a video. And that was blasted throughout the suburbs, which completely just gave us a shot of adrenaline. Mm. And all of a sudden, boomed us up to weekends, up to bigger venues. So that also helped. So the coincidence of a 24/7 locally owned TV music station was huge.
You did at least one video from Toy Boat, Toy Boat, Toy Boat is the Epic album.
Yes.
Which was a title designed to trip people up.
I know, which is really a bad move when you think about it. Titling your album with a tongue twister is not a way to endear yourself with DJs.
But you had at least one video.
We did. You know, yeah. And the Epic Records thing was really very frustrating because we had developed our fan base by sort of doing what we felt was right in our tummies, you know. Epic, they want a hit. And there was one song we had called Back in My Mind, which in retrospect, I really loved the track. But at the time, I kind of thought it was garagey and didn't want to do it. And we did it because it was, you know, I like a lot of stuff. And I can write a garage song. And it was fun. But they seized upon that as wanting to be a song that should be like a single. And actually, when we began recording it, we said, we'll do this in the context of an album. But please don't make it be the single because we're not like brainy or anything. But our substantial foundation had been sort of alt-rock, kind of indie rock thing. And so Back in My Mind, in the context of nine other songs, works fine, but please don't make it the single. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they hear the album and they want to make it the single. And so then we're like, oh my God. So we said, well, at least let us make a video for it. And we had a really fantastic idea for a video. We had these cardboard cutters of ourselves on stage. They were animated. So, you know, I'm rocking back and forth and the guitar player was windmilling, but he's made out of cardboard in front of a live audience going nuts. Right. So the idea was sort of the commodification of music in front of a live audience. Our project manager loved the video idea, but the Epic Records president, the new guy that came in, just looked at the past fiscal period and said, no more baby band videos. And so making this sort of sweeping statement. In those days, if the label wasn't behind you, everyone down the food chain realized that. And so they weren't going to spend time pushing a band that wasn't getting a video. And the video would have actually made the song a lot cooler because it was sort of a comment on, you know, two-dimensional rock stars and there's a whole kind of a commodification barcode thing. We had this takeoff of a 1920s photograph of the woman with the F holes on her back, and we put a barcode on her back, and so it was really kind of a cool video. It never got made. So the video goes out there. I mean, the song goes out there without any support. It does okay, and then they pick a second song which sounds almost like a Bruce Hornsby track called "Imagine That," which is a nice song, but again, complete disconnect from the first single. It's like, you know, who are these people? And then they give a video for that, sort of like, I shut these guys up, make a video. And at that point, I just felt so, I hadn't, like, I had no power. I was just in a boat without oars. I'm just like, whatever, okay, I'll be the, you know, the dancing monkey for the video. And I just felt like it was, you know, hopeless.
So obviously the relationship with Epic ended after the one album. How did that wind down?
Well, we were unhappy. They're unhappy. I mean, our project manager, the guy who's responsible for deciding what to happen, got fired before our album came out. So it's like you have this ocean liner with no one at the helm. It's not going to go anywhere. And no matter what you do, you're sort of just dithering around. And so someone else kind of came on and agreed to, like, or was assigned. You didn't even have a choice. Assigned as our project manager, who had never done it before. You know, you have, like, you know, kind of a novice captain, being careful, you know, and not necessarily being bold. And so we had a tepid novice, you know, and I love her dearly, project manager. And so we just felt like we didn't get the shot. Actually, I felt like we could have given them like Abbey Road and it wouldn't have mattered. It was really frustrating to realize that you can do your job and it didn't matter. And so I kind of, you know, lumped myself, I was thrown into the heap of the 99% of artists who, whatever the cause, their project didn't make it through the conveyor belt properly and just ended up not reaching their audience. Mm-hmm. And so that was really frustrating. And in the end, actually, ironically, the album we recorded, I think, great songs, but it's my least favorite because I think it's overly produced. Mm-hmm. And I'd much rather have something that's a bit more human sounding.
So having had that experience and now being in a situation where you, as both a lawyer, are working with up-and-coming artists and working with students at Northeastern, what do you perceive as the role of record labels today? I know that's an enormous question, but
right. Well, it's the same story with bands as it's ever been. You still need to be great, and you still need to be cognizant of the sort of the windows of consumption, like how people are accessing what it is you create. And that means YouTube, obviously. You know, I mean, if I were in a band now, I'd be so freaking excited because I wouldn't even think of myself as a band. I would think of myself as like a scene. Like I'm Andy Warhol and I'm creating this thing and music's a part of it, but so are visuals a part of it. And I would just be more like an Andy Warhol on the web using music as a thing I do and creating a video for every single quote-unquote song, but it being more of a, like, you know, a succulent experience to a video. And you're like, wow, what is that? And what is that? You know, if Shakespeare came along now, he might not use the Globe Theater. You know, if Scorsese comes along now, he maybe doesn't get the independent film funding. He maybe does little YouTube vignettes because that's the method of that's the means of consumption. So you channel your genius or whatever it is through those receptacles. I would not look at it like I'm in a band. You know, I'd look at it more like I'm in a, I don't know what it is.
Right.
I'm in a creative troupe that is musical for sure. And I would try to find like-minded or even contrarian people who bring something to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would look at other successful works or other successful ways of having those works. You know, what went viral? And I mean, I would want to go viral.
Right.
And be great. You know, be great, go viral. That would be what I would say. That's what I would do. And it's not just about success, but it's about, like, just attention. And I want to be great, though. I still want to be great. But there is – I mean, it's never been easier. It's, you know, and it's just as hard as it's ever been. But it's never been easier in a way. It's just how you think about it. And you people think about it as if it's 1995. And it's just not. And people – it's hard to break that inertia because, you know, this is the way that all the successful bands came down the pike. All this way, had a label, had the radio, you know, had the record stores, and that just ain't the way. And so looking at it, like comparing yourself to the way that Led Zeppelin arrived or the Beatles arrived, that's kind of foolish. The grassroots thing is just like limitless and phenomenal. And you got to be, you got to go to bed with your laptop, you know, you just got to be like so consumed by it. And you have to just be driven to the extreme. And that's always been the way.
Right. So if I think everything you're saying makes perfect sense from the perspective of an artist, there's a much more holistic approach to creativity now. It's not simply about making records. It's about performance. It's about video. It's about multimedia. It's about other sorts of things. We still generally – we've seen a lot of evolution in the way the record industry is organized. But at the end of the day, record labels own rights and recordings.
Right.
And – so what you're saying is would be troubling for a record label to be hearing.
Yeah, because I think record labels still specialize in mass media, you know, mechanisms or approaches. And if you want to, I think that it depends again what your goals are. If your goal is to get a record label, okay, then that's part of the goal. I never thought that was a goal. I sort of thought it was a means. Mm-hmm. The goal being reaching an audience. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, there's a problem now for the legacy companies that traffic in products through disappearing channels. And so the whole, you know, I'm a legacy company that is that it has done great things. But technology now has created the walls are not porous. And so now, you know, what would have been fine in the walls would have been fine and the liquid would have shot down that pipe. Now the pipes are porous. And so now not only is it inefficient, but it's also, frankly, not even necessary in terms of how people are going to find things. And so the labels and the major media companies are understandably very troubled by this. I get it. And I also think that there are certain truths that underlie the grassroots position and the sort of the major media company position that are the same. Like, I think artists should get paid. You know, hard to argue with that one. And I think that what the challenge of the industry is to sort of, instead of focusing on positions, which tend to be rigid, if I don't get my position, I'm going to fight to the death, you look at the interests that underlie your positions and then try to think about, okay, how can we achieve these interests without necessarily being rigid in the position? And that's hard. And, you know, and the law supports positions. And so the law supports these legacy companies. And so, therefore, why would not you resort to the law? Mm-hmm. And especially when these major companies have access to Congress in a big way. So Congress will continue to write the rules. And frankly, Congress relies upon the industries for expertise in drafting legislation anyway. So mm-hmm. I don't mean to put a too cynical spin on it, but Congress is being sold a snapshot of like 1995 in 2012, and it's just not it's not the whole picture. And there are, you know, copyright. You know, the statute of demand kind of copyright worked pretty fine in 1995. But then, you know, digitization just changed everything. You know, Napster really was the moment in The Wizard of Oz, you know, when the movie goes from black and white to color.
Mm-hmm.
That's that moment where all of a sudden everything is really different and you just can't really go back. And so I understand how the labels and the big companies feel, because the law was constructed in a way that really solidified the way that they did business, and they would love for the way that they did business to be perpetuated. I totally get that. But digital technology has really rendered their methodology non-essential. And so you can't – why should a non-essential practice be regulated and perpetuated?
Right.
And so – but the interests of the once upon a time essential practice was serving are still valid, but I think the way that you achieve those interests can't be through the maintenance of non-essential practices. It's not going to work. So we have to sort of, you know, look at certain emerging truths and interests, and, you know, if we landed on the shores of the earth now with technology magically existing as it does, mm-hmm. we wouldn't write the law the way it was written.
So if you had the ear of Congress
and the power to make them do things,
and the power to make them do things, where would you want to take us forgetting about business models, which we've been talking about, but up one level, where would you want to take us in terms of law and policy?
Well, I think that the bottom line is progress, and how do you achieve progress? And progress was reflected in the Constitution in a number of ways. you know, commerce is important, so they can regulate commerce. Mm-hmm. Also, the First Amendment is important, and I think and you know, copyright and the First Amendment are kind of at odds.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that if we value ourselves as a free society, and I don't mean, you know, I mean like as open and expressive, then I think that that should be one of the core components in this discussion. Freedom should be a core component. Not non-monetized, but freedom. And if you look back, there are some lessons we can learn. This technological disruption is not a new thing. If you look back at the 20th century, you know, radio, and which gave rise to certain mechanisms that I think still make a lot of sense, like ASCAP and BMI and CSAC, this idea of a collective licensing model. When the transactions became too innumerable to police individually, the songwriters invented ASCAP, in which all the content owners pool their rights, and then this entity issues, you know, sublicenses the right to use those works.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a essential component, some kind of performance rights mechanism. That said, you know, legacy is a bitch, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all these companies like Harry Fox and ASCAP. They both serve the same master. They serve the publishers. And neither one of them wants to give up turf in this new domain. And so so you have these entities like the labels, frankly, like anybody who is a human being would have their agenda for us, like employees at a record label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody wants to maintain their survival. And so nobody's going to want to say, you know what, for the greater good, I'm going to, you know, fall on the sword. It's like, no, not really. I'm not going to do that. And so so there is this, you know, agenda that's sort of not spoken about that won't permit people to really make the leap beyond that self-interest. But I do think that collective licensing is a principle that is that could be a solution. I also think if you look at the Audio Home Recording Act,
mm-hmm.
where, again, there was this digital kind of turbulence that was, you know, the record labels and the publishers were concerned about the loss of income because of serial copies that could be perfect, and the copy of a 10,000th generation copy would be the same mm-hmm. as the master's mother tape.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you know, that would just reduce the ability or the demand for that initial product. So Congress and the parties agreed, and they actually levied a tax. Oh my God, a tax! and the tax was like 2-3%, which seems to be the sweet spot. You know, that's what ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC do, 2-3%. It's below 5. You know, if you're above 5, that's like, oh, you're really kind of cutting in. But so 2-3%. So, you know, if you look at the past, if you look at collective licensing, and you look at the possibility of a tax, even though I know that, you know, the Grover Norquist pledge signers, the idea of a tax is just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if I was the enlightened despot, or if I could somehow convince Congress, I would say there should be a levy, and again, I know that's not going to happen, but on anything that enables digital internet functionality. So, you know, my iPhone, my SIM card, my laptop, ISP charges, everything. I mean, you could raise, I'm not even sure what it would be, billions and billions of dollars if there was a 2% across the board levy. And then it would also, one of the other, there are several things, several sort of principles that I've sort of come across in my time. One is this idea of free-ish.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to feel free. It can't be free because you can't have business if you're free. But it's got to feel free. And so a modest, way below the hood payment across the board would feel free. And if everybody pays it, then you're also sort of eliminating the hacking sort of motivation to get around it, because you already paid the tax when you bought your laptop. And so why mess with it? So free-ish, I think, is important. Also, another sort of undeniable truth, and frankly an undeniable positive, is that you know, the digital environment is uncontrollable. So embrace that. You know, copyright's about control, but control is not possible. So don't try to apply a less than sort of valuable methodology to a new environment. Again, if I came down to the earth in 2012 and this technology existed, and I was trying to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say, better control it, because that's not really, you know, if there was no value system in place except just what we want to try to do as the founders of this new country with the First Amendment, control would not be, you know, part of that. And so don't try to control it. Have a very small levy and sort of instead of trying to control the ocean, let the water go where it will and just monetize the drops in a way that's not – that feels kind of free-ish.
So how do you feel about that lack of control as an artist? Because you were talking earlier about sort of collective licensing schemes, and we have some areas of the law that where we have compulsory licenses that allow us to do things essentially without getting the copyright owner's position. I can permission. I can cover one of your songs right. as long as I get a compulsory license. I can create an online streaming radio service as long as I just pay SoundExchange the right amount. They'll divvy it up. That's great in terms of licensing efficiency. There's an enormous volume of music. Music rights are complicated. You know, compulsory licenses, statutory licenses, collective licensing simplifies that. It does rob content owners of control. And to your last point, is that something that artists should feel comfortable with? The more there are statutory licensing, compulsory licensing regimes, the less I'm able to say, I don't want you to use my work in this particular context.
Right. Well, I don't think they should feel comfortable with it, but I think change is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that change is. And you can fight against it and gnash your teeth, but it just is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the reality is you just need to accept it and work with it and embrace the lack of control. You know what? Okay, I'm going to go in. You know, I'm going to do it because there is no control. And it's going to create some really artistically painful conclusions. You know, you could use, you know, a Motown song in a Ku Klux Klan video. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be horrible. And the whole notion of moral rights, you know, the idea of being able to control what happens. I think that, you know, there's been this recognition of artists as, you know, almost divine, you know, this sort of droit moral, mm-hmm. you know, and that creativity is a manifestation of this godlike principle. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And I totally, you know, feel like when I'm creating something that it's kind of coming from someplace else. Like I really don't disagree with the idea that an artist feels pride over. It's almost like children, you know, and you don't want to see anybody messing with your kids, you know. But these are analogies that were created in a certain period, in a certain time when control was possible, and it's understandable. But, you know, but I think now you just have to weigh, you know, what are the principles? What do you want to try to what's going to weigh heavier? Is it going to be control, as in, you know, record label or content owner control or artist control, but what can happen, versus freedom to comment? And frankly, you know, that old adage, you know, freedom for the speech we hate. And I think that in a free society, if someone does something heinous with your song and makes a bad video, they'll be ridiculed for that. And if anything, it may give you a chance as the person whose art was defiled to get on the soapbox and criticize that, and let the person who did the, you know, who was so, you know, defiling of the art be, you know, be susceptible to discussion.
Sure.
About that.
Right.
So I think that in the end, I would say that one of the slight casualties in a free society, not as, you know, not for the open software, not as free beer, but, you know, free speech,
mm-hmm.
free society is, yeah, you know, certain things are going to bump you the wrong way. It's rough and tumble, and I know it's your art, but I think there needs to be, I think in the scheme of things, if it were 2012, clean slate copyright, I would say that it's control is impossible. Expressiveness is to be encouraged, but coming up with a solution for the major companies is the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the hard part. And frankly, you know, I like blockbuster films. You know, I like having these big cultural touch points, like to be able to say that, you know, that this person is like Darth Vader. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. You know, what I lament, and again, it's like, oh, well, you know, is there are going to be these losses of everybody knows what I'm talking about. There'll be niches of communities that will know, and there'll be some things that everyone knows, but the sort of the mass media Ed Sullivan moment or the George Lucas moment. Well, the just sort of, you know, mega sort of, you know, Harry Potter thing, they'll continue to exist, But they cost so much money to make. And then, you know, if you release these things into a open environment where there's no monetization, that really cuts against the impulse to invest in them in the first place. And so, but I would love to sort of see what kind of study could be done mm-hmm. if we really did have a 2% tax on everything. And they're really, and one of the things you have to do is you need like a world registry, like a big database where all the objects that are flowing through the system have a, you know, sort of common denominator in this big system, which is massive.
Oh, yeah.
That's just massive. But I think, you know, I bet if there was a tax, oh, my God, movies that were torrented or things that were shared, if there was some way of sort of anonymously ticking off those things and fighting it against, you know, being botted, so you have somebody just sort of racking up their own score on fake popularity. If you, and yet you address privacy issues and antitrust issues. I mean, it's massive. It's mm-hmm. massive. But again, you know, in 4 or 5 sentences, you can sketch out what would be the ideal landscape. But there are, you know, each one of those things is fraught with complete knockdown, drag out fights, like yep. governmental taking of property, imposing sort of compensation structures upon private companies that have invested money, loss of freedom. I mean, in a way here, you're sort of, in the name of freedom, you are increasing regulation. Sure. So it seems very...
And those are hard, you know, antitrust and privacy, and those are tough issues. You talk about a registry. We've heard people talk for years about how we need copyright registries. It seems to me like people on all sides of all issues, whether you're a content owner and a licensor or someone that's a use, everyone should want there to be some sort of a registry, and even that's been impossible. Well,
because there are smaller companies that have their own little sub-registries mm-hmm. and don't want to lose their rights. Right. And so in Europe, you have like 28 registries, mm-hmm. and so nobody wants to, lose their little kingdom. And so you have this little inefficient kingdom, and you know, you have a patchwork of inefficient kingdoms. And so nobody wants to give up their little oil well. And so it's really hard. And then then once you've done this, like once the government, the enlightened, you know, perfect hand of government comes in and wipes the slate clean and tells the population what you'll pay and tells the creators what you'll get paid, that's kind of scary. You know, you can easily paint a socialistic, oh my God, you know, sort of a doomsday, big brother. And frankly, with human nature being what it is, at every step along the way, you know, the path to divine intentions, you know, is going to be sabotaged by people who see an opportunity for themselves to kind of do something that's not in furtherance of the mission.
Right.
So, so that's... But I do think collective licensing, and I do think this could even be a solution for the whole industry. If you had a pull-down menu on production environments, we could say, the players here were this, and that automatically went from your Pro Tools system right to their registry database.
Right.
You know, everybody doing it at source when you're doing it.
Assign each track a number,
right,
a barcode.
And even a blogger.
Yeah.
Well, the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So when they put up their article, and you go there, you know, each person has their own like barcode generator. So you could put metadata on your stuff, and when it gets hit by any kind of traffic, you know, it ticks off a micropayment to your account. That could work, but it's never going to happen.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Berkman. Dave Hurley, he is a lawyer, father, associate academic specialist at Northeastern University, formerly of O Positive, currently of Hey Dave. Is that everything?
Yeah, just about. That's all I want to reveal anyway.
Great. Thanks again, Dave.
Thank you, Chris.
This week's show was produced by Dan Jones and Francis Harlow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Special thanks to our guest host, Chris Babbitts, and to O Positive for providing the soundtrack. You can find more episodes and information about Radio Berkman at cyber.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. We're also on Twitter as Radio Berkman, one word, and you can like us on Facebook.